May it please the Court, counsel for Mr. Bailey and counsel for the government. Your Honor, this case presents some unusual facts. As is conceded by the trial court, this was a deal that was conceived of by an individual named Davenport and a government informant as a 1 kilo heroin deal on December the 14th of 2004. Mr. Gilmer's involvement in this case began on the day of his arrest, January the 3rd of 2005. Mr. Gilmer, and then there's conflicting testimony. Mr. Gilmer is in a was in a park, and he indicated he was talking to an individual named Williams, and Mr. Williams agreed to give Mr. Gilmer a ride to his car, which had broken down near his wife's apartment. The issues that I'd like to talk about, we're splitting our argument up, 5 minutes for each side on opening. I'm going to reserve 3 minutes at the end. Are B1 and 2 of our brief, and I would also like to make reference to the 404B argument that appears in our brief. This court, for a long time, has held that in order to find someone guilty of conspiracy, the court has required certain factors to be satisfied in the record. Some of those factors in this particular case just do not exist, and there was no evidence to support them. We also point out in our reply brief in this case that there was little of substance to argue that the government argued in response to these two arguments. What we know, and I think that's important, is that we have a 1 kilo deal on the part of the DEA, and we have Rommel Williams, the key witness for the government against Mr. Gilmer, and a man with numerous drug distribution convictions.
An altogether bad man, no question about it.
Some worse than others. And we have Mr. Williams testifying that he never intended more than 100 kilos. So we have a real problem here, and it was a problem for the trial court as to what was the conspiracy. So the government has the kilo deal. Mr. Williams, who is arrested and at the time of his arrest has less than 100 kilograms of heroin in his possession, testified he never intended to deal with more. And the record also shows that no one involved in this case, none of the defendants, had ever done a deal of this magnitude.
Well, that sounds like jury questions rather than legal questions for us.
Well, Judge, there are the legal questions have to do with
a jury waiver. We have to rely on Judge Shader.
Right, the bench judge.
That's correct, Judge. And of course, we did cite a case in our briefs in which the court reviewed another conspiracy case involving Judge Shader and reversed for very similar kinds of issues. And that is that we don't have the factors here. Let me just run down the factors. We don't have a meeting of the minds as to what this conspiracy is about. We don't have a stake shown by Mr. Gilmer. The evidence is undisputed that Mr. Gilmer was to take nothing in this deal. Mr. Williams, the only person who had the goods, said he never intended to give Mr. Gilmer anything. That's at 329 in the transcript. He did not trust Mr. Gilmer. So we don't have a long prior set of dealings, course of conduct between the two men exemplifying trust. The only drugs, as I indicated before, were found on Rommel Williams. There is no evidence of an agreement between Mr. Williams and Mr. Gilmer to further the scheme. There's really no evidence of any meeting of minds. The reason that the trial judge found Mr. Gilmer guilty of conspiracy at trial was basically found at 817 of the transcript, and that's when Judge Shader said that two prior drug dealings between Mr. Gilmer and Mr. Williams created the necessary predicate for his finding of guilty of conspiracy here. Now, that 404B argument, which requires that the prior offense, which occurred sometime in apparently in early December of 2004, be somehow inextricably entwined with the charged offense. In fact, the record shows that there was almost no evidence as to what happened during those alleged deals. Even though we raised it and filed a motion on it, the government did not supply any particular information from Mr. Williams to identify it. I do want to say 5 minutes, Judge. Our position is that on these arguments that under both the four.
But Gilmer arranged the transaction, didn't he? I don't know what you're.
The government is relying on the Bruton excluded evidence for that information, Judge. In fact, it's a little difficult to understand how Gilmer could arrange the transaction since he didn't know Mr. Bailey, and Mr. Bailey didn't know him, and Mr.
That's
Williams.
That's the way to do a conspiracy, right? You want to minimize how many people each of them knows.
Well, that could be, Judge. But I don't think that there's any record here upon which to predicate the conspiracy charge, and I do think that if that falls, and because the Pinkerton doctrine, as we pointed out, was the sole basis for finding him guilty of the distribution, that should be reversed. Otherwise, it should be reversed and remanded under 404B.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Moran. Mr. D.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am representing Jamar Bailey, one of the appellants in this case, and I'm going to focus my time this morning on Mr. Bailey's sufficiency of the evidence argument. And in particular, I want to focus on the fundamental disconnect between the government's theory of liability against Mr. Bailey and the evidence that the trial court relied on to convict Mr. Bailey. And first, let's talk about what the government's theory is. The government's theory is that each conspirator in this case comprised a link in a chain, and that Mr. Bailey was a critical link. Specifically, the government's claim is that Mr. Bailey's role was to obtain the heroin from Mr. Wilson, that he reached out to Mr. Gilmer to get the heroin, and that he served as a conduit between the parties and negotiated a place to meet. Now, in their brief, the government, to support their theory of liability, relied on Mr. Gilmer's post-arrest statement and Agent Mockoff's testimony about Mr. Gilmer's post-arrest statement. The problem with that is that Mr. Gilmer's post-arrest statement and the testimony about his post-arrest statement is inadmissible. It violates constitutional rights of Mr. Bailey under the Supreme Court's decisions in Lee and in Bruton. And indeed, the trial court, Judge Shader, specifically and properly excluded Mr. Gilmer's post-arrest statement and Agent Mockoff's testimony about his post-arrest statement from consideration of Mr. Bailey's culpability. So that evidence does not and cannot form the basis for affirming Mr. Bailey's conviction. Now let's turn to the evidence that the trial court did rely on in convicting Mr. Bailey. And specifically, what the trial court relied on heavily was Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement, which the court characterized as being totally damning. Now, the problem is that Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement does not provide any substantial evidence to support the government's theory that Mr. Bailey provided the heroin for Mr. Wilson, that he obtained it, that he reached out to Mr. Gilmer to get the heroin, or that he was acted as a conduit between the parties and negotiated a place to meet. Nowhere in the post-arrest statement does Mr. Bailey suggest that he was the one who contacted Mr. Gilmer. To the contrary, his post-arrest statement indicates that it was Cleon Wilson who contacted Mr. Gilmer. Now, in their brief, the government suggests...
So then what are we to do? I mean, I thought the court also found Wilson's testimony credible, that Bailey came to Wilson's home and said he could get the heroin, that Wilson testified Bailey said he would go out west for the heroin, would contact him when it was ready. I mean, there was lots of testimony by Wilson about Bailey.
Yes, and you have to put that in context with the court's statement that it was really relying on Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement to corroborate that other evidence.
To corroborate the testimony of Wilson.
And to the extent, and the judge said this, that he recognized the doubts and inconsistencies on the evidence outside the post-arrest statement, but to the extent the post-arrest statement, to use the judge's words, meshed with that outside evidence, mm-hmm. it corroborated that evidence. Mm-hmm. And the evidence outside the post-arrest statement that you just mentioned, that he was going out west, all of that is not corroborated by Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement. For example, there's testimony from Wilson that Bailey called him and said he had a key available. He had found a key. None of that is corroborated in Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement.
I don't understand you. What is your conception of Bailey's role in this transaction?
Well, the evidence, according to the post-arrest statement, is that he knew about the deal, one. He definitely was there for several of the, and throughout several of the transactions that took place that others executed. And he rode in the car with both Mr. Wilson and Mr.
So what do you think he was doing? Just amusing himself?
Well, he was friends with Wilson. He was, as he said in his post-arrest statement, chilling with Mr. Wilson. I mean, he was along for the ride, but I think importantly...
What does that mean, along for the ride?
Well, he was along for the ride. He testified, or his post-arrest, he didn't testify.
With a drug dealer to a drug transaction? That sounds pretty implausible.
Well, let's talk about, there is an analogous fact pattern that this court has addressed in United States versus Baker, where there the defendant actually was there in the presence of the drug deal being discussed between the buyer and seller, and then the actual defendant drove the drug dealer to the location of the transaction with full knowledge that was the purpose of driving the drug dealer there for the transaction, and knew that the drug dealer had the drugs on him for the purpose of selling the drugs. And this court held that was not sufficient evidence to demonstrate active participation.
That sure doesn't sound right.
Well, that's the ruling of this court.
That doesn't sound right. And what case
court,
is that?
I don't... United States versus Baker. And it's cited in our brief. And here you've got an even more tenuous connection with Mr. Bailey, who was not driving the car but along for the ride.
Now, you don't have strangers riding along in drug transactions. That's not how they do it.
Well, that's certainly being in the mere presence of others who are conducting a drug deal is not sufficient.
I understand that. The drug people, the druggies, the drug dealers, they're not going to take someone along for a ride just to satisfy the person's curiosity about what a drug deal is like.
Well, there is there's no question that Mr. Wilson and Mr. Bailey knew each other, and they were hanging out together that day. So mere association itself is not sufficient to provide substantial evidence of involvement in a conspiracy. With that, I'd like to reserve time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dean. Mr. Block?
May it please the court.
What about this Baker case? You didn't cite it in your brief.
No, Judge, and I heard counsel's argument on that point that in this case, the evidence is not that there was merely a ride-along or a presence here, but there is substantial evidence related to each of these defendants of their role in this conspiracy that has nothing to do with Bruton. For example, taking Mr. Bailey first, there's a testimony of Mr. Wilson, which is another co-conspirator, which at this point the court must construe in the light most favorable to the government. Wilson testified that he contacted Bailey. He knew him for about a year. He testified that Bailey said he'd get a kilogram of heroin from out west. Agents observed Wilson talking to Bailey on his cell phone. Wilson testified that Bailey told him he wanted to meet on the west side to discuss a heroin deal. Wilson attempted to call the deal off. Bailey then called back, and this is Wilson's testimony, and said no, he needed the money. He needed this deal to take place. Wilson testified that he and Bailey agreed to do the deal at a laundromat. You also have Davenport's testimony, another co-conspirator in this case. Again, doesn't implicate Bruton at all. Davenport testified that Bailey got into a car with him and Wilson. Wilson introduced him to Bailey, introduced Bailey to Davenport and Salazar, who's the confidential informant, and there's an in-court ID of Bailey. Davenport testified that Salazar, the informant, asked Bailey if he had the drugs on him. Bailey said no, they were in the car with his people. And Davenport further testified that Bailey asked him about the money. This is not a case where there's merely presence at the scene of a drug transaction. Davenport testified that Bailey made a phone call from a Cadillac Escalade that they were in, and he then told them that another car would be pulling up shortly with the additional co-conspirators. In addition, you have Bailey's post-arrest statement in this case, which the judge did find corroborated this other evidence. It wasn't the sole evidence.
What did you mean when you said that this evidence of another transaction was inextricably interwoven?
Judge,
you read our Taylor case?
I did, Judge. I did.
Why couldn't it have been extricated?
Pardon me, Judge?
Why couldn't it have been extricated? You say inextricably interwoven. Why couldn't it be extricated?
I think it was inextricably intertwined in this case because it explains how Williams knew Gilmer, why they had a conversation about this conspiracy. Without that, there was a void in this story. Remember, and counsel alluded to this was a vertically integrated conspiracy where each one had a role on the sell side of the transaction to procure the heroin. There was testimony in this case about how each of these individuals knew each other. There was testimony that Davenport knew the CI, Salazar, because they had been friends for 3 years, and Salazar and Davenport testified as to that. There's testimony that Davenport knew Wilson because they were friends from high school for 15 years. Wilson testified he knew Bailey socially and would spend time at his house. And there's also testimony from Gilmer's post-arrest statement that he got Bailey's number from his cousin. The only thing that would be missing in this link would be the testimony about how Williams knew Gilmer. That's why it's inextricably intertwined. Without that evidence, there is a void in this story. And that was what the evidence was admitted for in this case. It's not propensity evidence. It was admitted to show how Williams knew Gilmer and why he called him. And the judge said that on the record. He said, why else would Gilmer come to Williams with a question as to whether he could obtain a quarter to a half kilo of heroin? And that's in the transcript of page 819. So that's why we believe that it's inextricably intertwined in this case. Going back to the sufficiency argument, I've gone through the evidence against Defendant Bailey. There's also substantial evidence against Defendant Gilmer that has nothing to do with Bruton in this case. Williams testified, another co-conspirator, not to be confused with Wilson, this is Williams, that he knew Gilmer from a...
How much of Gilmer's post-arrest statement did the judge exclude?
Well, he excluded all of it as to Defendant Bailey. He said he was only going to consider it...
As to Gilmer.
As to Gilmer, right. As to Gilmer, Williams testified that Davenport came looking for a kilogram of heroin and that he, Williams, agreed to go looking for it. His testimony that he talked to Bailey. Bailey said he was looking for a kilo. Bailey said he could get it. Bailey got on his cell phone. Williams testified that he was approached by Gilmer. Gilmer asked him if he could get a hold of some dope, heroin, and he said he wanted about a quarter to half a kilo. This is all in-court testimony. It doesn't implicate Bruton at all. Williams told Gilmer, give him about an hour. Gilmer told him the dope was for his friend's cousin. In addition, in this case, to go to the argument that there was sort of mere presence, on the day of the transaction, there were 27 phone calls between Wilson and Bailey. There were 16 phone calls between Bailey and Gilmer. This case charged a limited conspiracy on that day, and a conspiracy, as the court knows, can be explicit or implicit, and there is substantial evidence in this case as to agreement between these parties.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Block.
Thank
so,
you.
Mr. Moran, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Your Honor, I'd just like to iterate that under the Mentine case that we cited in our brief for the conspiracy charge, prolonged, actively pursued course of sales, knowledge, and shared stake need to be shown by the government. That's not shown against Mr. Gilmer in this case. Cleon Wilson testified he didn't know Mr. Gilmer from a hole in the head. He never talked to him. He didn't know anything about Mr. Gilmer.
It's a hole in the ground, not a hole in the head, but go ahead.
It must be my head, Judge. As far as the Bruton level, I think if you examine the record, you'll see that the trial judge basically said that he wasn't going to consider Mr. Gilmer's or Mr. Bailey's statements, period. Not that he was... he started off by talking about not against each other, but Later on, the record shows he wasn't going to talk about either. Now, this issue came up because
be
of the government's response.
What would be the basis for that? Why couldn't he consider Gilmer's statement against Gilmer?
Well, Judge, I think because otherwise, I believe that we had withdrawn, I'll have to go check the record, but withdrawn a motion to suppress any statements by Mr. Gilmer. But the way the case came down, the court said that this is an easier way to deal with this. I'll give my opposing, my co-counsel.
Yeah, okay, Mr. D.
Very briefly, Your Honors. The government did cite other evidence outside the post-arrest statement of Mr. Bailey that did exist, but it is worth noting that Judge Shader, when he examined that evidence, he made comments that he recognized the doubts on that evidence caused by the inconsistencies and the credibility issues with respect to each of the defendants or each of those witnesses. And he credited the testimony and the evidence to the extent that it meshed with Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement. So, yes, Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement wasn't the only piece of evidence the court considered and found and gave weight to. He also considered evidence outside the record that meshed with that post-arrest statement, and none of that evidence outside the record that meshed with Mr. Bailey's post-arrest statement supports the government's theory of liability against Mr. Bailey. He didn't. There's no evidence in the post-arrest statement that he obtained the heroin from Mr. Gilmer or that he provided it to Mr. Wilson. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. D and Mr. Moran. You were appointed, and we appreciate your vigorous efforts on behalf of your clients.